This is HPC Wire Soundbite, your weekly source of commentary and insight on the HPC stories shaping the industry. With Michael Feldman, editor of HPC Wire, and Addison Snell, CEO of Intersect 360 Research. And now, here are your hosts, Michael Feldman and Addison Snell.
Workstations and tape libraries start the ball rolling on a series of SC09 announcements. Intel and AMD bury the hatchet, well, sort of, and the annual Seymour Cray Award travels to Japan. But will it be for the last time in a while? Hello and welcome to a special SC09 preview edition of HPC Wire Soundbite for Friday, November 13th, 2009. I'm Addison Snell, CEO of Intersect 360 Research, joined by my co-host, Michael Feldman, editor of HPC Wire. Michael, it's Friday the 13th, and we're headed to Portland for the biggest show of the year. And I've got one question for you. Do you feel lucky?
Well, I feel busy. I think I'll be lucky if I make it through next Friday alive. That's when I'll consider myself lucky.
Well, we've certainly got a lot going on, both of us. This is always a busy time of year for us. And as we predicted, the announcements have started to heat up, huh?
Yeah, we saw a couple big announcements this week, and then a couple announcements not really much to do with HPC, but in the IT industry that surrounds us all, that were fairly big as well.
Yeah, it doesn't rest much. Well, we've got a packed show today. Maybe we should dive right into it, starting with the Cray CX1 coming out in a workstation flavor.
Right, that was a very interesting announcement. They put that out earlier in the week, and it was basically, like you said, it was a workstation in their CX1 desktop system, their HPC personal system. Basically, it pre-configures a Windows 7 workstation and a Windows HPC server cluster inside a single box. The idea is just to make an integrated sort of client-server machine for personal use and for workgroup users that other workstations can hook into for people moving up from technical workstations into this HPC arena. It was pretty interesting, and I guess it was basically something they could already have done with a CX1. Like, you could go in and configure that more or less yourself and build that yourself, but this was one that was basically pre-configured, you know, with all the software and the software stack, the Windows on each side, and they're selling it as such. It's basically an out-of-the-box experience for workstation users that want to get into HPC.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And they're calling it, I think, the CX1 IWS for integrated workstation or something like that. But I got to say, you're going to know what I'm going to say is that I love this as a concept. I've been talking about calling these personal supercomputers workstations and going after that opportunity for a while now because it really lets them attack this largely vacated space that used to be such a huge part of the technical computing market, where engineers can have a system on their desktop that's going to integrate their workstation application environments with enough HPC resources to do some real work on a workstation. We've gotten to the point where workstation is kind of like a high-end gaming platform, and really this is going to bring it back into the engineering space. And furthermore, ISVs should love it because it gets people stepping up into HPC clusters in a less fearful way. In a way that should ultimately be easier to adopt.
Right. When I talked to the folks at Cray, the ISVs were on board with this. They do like this idea because it gives them a platform that their customers are very comfortable with. So it's good all around. You know, one thing I wrote about in the article is I think where this is heading, at least for personal use, is maybe to just be a pure workstation where you wouldn't even have a server cluster in there. You'll just have a 32-core workstation at some point. Especially when we're seeing the Nehalem EX coming out in 2010, as well as, you know, AMD's, of course, they're going to have their 8-core and 12-core systems or chips coming out next year.
Yeah,
it's going to be easy to build a big workstation now.
I think there's a big potential for that, especially in light of what we were talking about on our podcast last week with technologies like ScaleMP or 3Leaf, where you could turn these into virtual SMPs and do away with the problem of having someone try to step up to MPI for the first time just because they want to try to run Abacus.
Right. But at the same time, they'll be able to run MPI even in these SMP type shared memory machine. So it solves a lot of problems for them. So I think Cray, in doing this, is maybe going in that direction. Not to say that all CX1s will be like that, but maybe they'll will develop another model that will be just a pure workstation and not be necessarily a work group system at all.
And I think the final thing really worth mentioning about this product is that Cray really has some key partnerships lined up around it to support Cray in its quest for higher volume for this.
Right. It's obviously Microsoft here and Intel, but they're actually giving exclusive reseller rights to Dell here,
yep.
Which I thought was a little bit unusual. I mean, Dell, it's good for them. They can sell their other workstations and storage around this that can connect to this because there's it's meant to be used as a work group system as well.
Yep.
I'm not sure why they didn't go with more resellers. I mean, for their regular CX1 line, they've got dozens of resellers.
But for a product like this with people who are really used to selling workstations, I like this notion of going with Dell that's got an established sales channel that's more robust than Cray's reseller channel. They're used to selling workstations, and this Cray CX1 doesn't directly overlap with the existing Dell line because it's higher end. It outscales the top of the line Dell workstation. So to me, it makes sense.
Yeah, and maybe if they'd gone to HP, maybe there'd be more of a conflict of product sets there. Maybe that wouldn't have worked out. But
yeah, I think that's essentially it. Is Cray and Dell could find mutual benefit here without stepping on each other's toes too much. And the key success factor for Cray in this is going to be establishing enough volume to get it to work. I don't think the problem's with the technology. I love the technology, and it becomes a sales channel issue.
Right.
So Dell is going to be key. How about our other announcement that we were teeing up, going to a different technology in a different part of the ecosystem and entirely up at the high end with Spectralogic and the T-Finity tape libraries?
Right. They just came out with their new, like you said, T-Finity tape library this week. And that's it's a top-end system. It offers a 45 petabyte or up to 45 petabyte archive library for these really large systems. And I think you can actually splice them together and make a 180 petabyte multi-library system out of it. So that's as big as any HP system is going to need for a few years at least.
Right. It scales to hundreds of petabytes using the overhead exchanges if you connect multiple rows up to 100 frames. So it's massively scalable.
Yeah, I mean, Spectra, we haven't talked about it a whole lot in the past, but we haven't talked about tape archive systems in the past because it's one of the things people in the HPC business, they sort of just take for granted. It's back there. It's in the back room doing its thing for archiving, doing nearline archiving, but Spectra has made a point of targeting this market space. They've come on the scene pretty quickly within the last couple of years, and they made a big play. They brought on people from the industry into their advisory board to sort of guide them in as far as requirements, and T-Finity's is one of the outcomes of that. A lot of the functionality and capability in T-Finity is aimed at the HPC space. I mean, Spectra sells to a lot of markets, media and entertainment, federal government, enterprise as well. But the T-Finity is especially targeted to HPC and then to a lesser extent those other markets.
Well, and I think it's appropriate that people are looking at tape here for a couple of reasons. And one of them is that even if you look at the normal expected exponential growth in storage, which is already this hideous tsunami that people are dealing with in terms of data, there are even a couple of industries within that are going super linear in terms of their requirements because of changes in their own ecosystem. So just as a couple of examples, oil and gas with the transition to wide azimuth data that they're collecting is going orders of magnitude larger in their data sets to go to higher fidelity. You've got media and entertainment, which you just mentioned, which is converting everything over not only to things like digital movies, but also high definition broadcasting, which is huge increases in the size of the data files. And then the other one that's been talked about quite a lot is in medical research, not only with the digitization of medical scans, but also looking at regulations like HIPAA in the U.S. or similar regulations abroad that are requiring medical facilities to store data for longer periods of time in a secure fashion. So there are certainly industries that are pointing the way where tape is just going to have to be an enduring part of people's HPC environments.
Right, right. I think that's a good point. I mean, we're seeing these huge data sets being generated, a lot of it around imaging, but certainly across the industry. And I think we'll see more of that. And the fact that there'll be these tape systems now that can handle that will maybe even spur that on to a greater degree.
Right. And with Tfinity, Spectra is really addressing this in a way that does speak toward scalability. Some of the interest is, see, the thing about the word scalability to me is sometimes people just use it to mean biggest, whereas really scalable ought to mean that you can go up and down within the line. And the impressive thing with the T series to me, with the Tfinity at the top end, is that first of all, you can upgrade all the way up and down that line in increments of something like 10 tapes. And then furthermore, it's all the same software up and down. They've got the same, they kind of designed the software for the top end and then use that software throughout. So it really is a part of this T series line, although they've got a much more scalable product at the top now.
Right, and it's not like they don't have competition, but I think, you know, with this line, they've taken basically the top rung. I think their closest competition is a Sun Microsystems Storage Tech tape unit, which scales nearly as big, but doesn't have quite the same capabilities across the whole feature set.
Right, and with Sun, anything with Sun that we've been talking about recently, you've got the added complication of what's going to happen with the Sun Oracle acquisition, and the Oracle Sun acquisition, I should say, and is Oracle going to continue to invest in these storage tech tape libraries? Maybe they will, maybe they won't. But since the whole point of tape to begin with is to protect the access to this data over the long term, I think that has to be a concern for people. And we had Sun Oracle in the news again this week. With the European Commission, stating their specific objections to the deal and why they think it's anti-competitive. And now Oracle, of course, has objected to that and said that they're going to prove why it's not anti-competitive, and here's why the European Commission doesn't know what it's talking about. But at the least, it's another delay in the Sun Oracle deal, which just keeps dragging on and on and leaves all these Sun technologies kind of sitting there waiting to figure out what's going on.
Right, and I think Spectra has intentionally taken advantage of this. I think they've actually gone out and talked to customers and said, look, you know, we're offering this system today. Here's our roadmap. I mean, if you're with Sun, where's their roadmap? What are they even going to be doing a year from now? So, I mean, Spectra has definitely taken the fight to Sun, and like you said, I mean, it's just still up in the air, and then there's this other thing that came up this week. Now, it'll probably all go through in the end, and maybe the EU is just trying to pressure Oracle to drop the MySQL part and sell it off and make it go through, but I think one way or another, this is set to happen. It's hard to think that this acquisition deal will not go through at this point.
No, I think it'll go through. Oracle will keep fighting it. They might have to reach some compromise on a thing or two at some point. But you're right. Right. Spectralogic is just add them to the list of companies that's going to be trying to, you know, take competition right to Sun for as long as they can. I think at ISC, Spectra had in their booth, they had their footprint drawn inside the Sun storage tech footprint to show off the density. So, I mean, it's definitely right in their sights to go after as many storage tech customers as they can, as fast as they can. With regards to regulations, there was another regulation story that was in the news. It's not directly into HPC, although it does have some overarching consequences, which is the so-called truce settlement between Intel and AMD.
Yeah, that came into the news very late in the week. And yeah, apparently Intel has settled its antitrust lawsuit with AMD that's been ongoing for years now, it seems like. They're going to pay him $1.25 billion, which, you know, it's not a lot of money to Intel, but to AMD, that's a lot of money.
A lot their of stock money to me, too. Right? It's billions of dollars, right? I mean, that's a lot.
Yeah. Well, it hurts Intel, too. I mean, that's a big check to write. But, you know, Intel stock stock barely took a bump, whereas AMD stock soared on that news. So it's you know, it's a lot of money to a smaller company like AMD. But yeah, the settlement, it doesn't stop these other antitrust cases out there with the EU, which has already fined Intel $1.5 billion, I think, and Intel's appealing that. And then there's this other case with in New York. So those government lawsuits will go on in some fashion, but maybe this settlement will affect those down the road, since they've made the settlement with AMD. Maybe it'll affect the fines or even how those cases go forward.
Do you think that this payoff is an admission of guilt by Intel, and is it the right thing for them to be doing?
I think it is the right thing for them to be doing, because they couldn't really afford to go into court and risk losing several times this amount. With all these cases piling up and sort of the anti-corporate perception that's going on in the country and the world right now, I think they didn't want to risk losing several times that $1.25 billion in a court case.
Yeah.
Plus, it's distracting. Now, whether it's an admission of guilt or not, Intel would say no. AMD would say yes. I think generally it is an admission of guilt that they basically agreed to not offer these types of price inducements anymore. Now, Intel wouldn't say anymore, but they've listed them. They say we're not going to induce customers based on all these criteria that AMD has been complaining about for years.
Yeah, I would stop short of saying it's an admission of guilt, but I would say that it's an admission that there was a very real possibility that they were going to lose, right?
Yeah.
Regardless of whether they claim to have been guilty or not, they could have been found guilty, and that could have cost them substantially more, in addition to the cost, as you were saying, of trying the case and the ongoing distraction. So I think it is something that they had to do in an attempt to move forward. I think Intel might also hope that this will get the FTC to relax and stop trying to bring its own case if Intel, if AMD isn't complaining. I don't know whether that's going to work or not, but Intel is probably hoping. As for the rest of it, with all these concessions, I think that's much ado about nothing. AMD is touting this as a great victory, that they've gotten Intel to say that they're not going to do all of these things. But it's a list of things that are all illegal anyway. So, of course, Intel is going to say that they're not going to do them. They'll say, we weren't doing them before. We're not going to do them anymore. We're not going to do them ever. So, I mean, you know, what's the big deal in getting Intel to say they're not going to do it?
Well, it's written down now, so AMD can go back and point to specific language and saying, well,
you said you weren't going to. It's written down before. It's
the law. Yeah. This is a little different. I mean, there was a list of, I think, half a dozen or a dozen things that I think were fairly specific. And, yeah, I mean, Intel would say, well, we haven't really been doing them, but well, there's other things they also agreed to. They're also, AMD's not going to be paying royalties anymore to Intel. There's based on an earlier cross-patent or patent cross-license agreement. So those Intel royalties will stop. And Intel also agreed to sort of stop bugging about the global foundries split, where they split off the fab to this new company. Intel had a problem with that because that wasn't as part of the original cross-license agreement. But they basically let up on that. So,
yeah,
AMD can divest itself completely if they want now of that company, and then go on and be a fabless company, and everything's copacetic.
Well, in terms of the licensing, I think you can look at that in terms of it's part of the cost of the payoff that Intel's going after, right? That's just another form of payment. The fabless thing does make a difference going forward, but I think it's also Intel saying, well, you know, we don't really want you have you as a partner that much anymore either, right?
Right,
so,
right.
Those are all things that we can look at. Well, gosh, now that we're getting so close to supercomputing, there's a lot of stuff starting to heat up, and we're going to have a bunch of shows coming up over the course of the next week. On Tuesday, we're going to be looking at top 500 list. You're going to have the HPC Wire Awards coming out. There will be a whole new raft of press releases. One thing that we're already looking at in terms of top 500, though, is it looks like Japan is really backed off of it, huh?
Yeah, I mean, who knows how many will show up on the list this time, but, I mean, they just announced, well, I don't know if they announced, but Reuters just had a story this morning basically saying that the government's going to freeze spending on their next generation supercomputer. This is their their project to build a 10 petaflop system that's supposed to be deployed, I think, in the 2011-2012 time frame.
Right, the Beacon basically, system.
Yeah, right. It was used to be a three-company system. It used to be NEC and Hitachi and Fujitsu, and then back, I think, in May, NEC and Hitachi bailed out on it. Maybe they saw the writing on the wall here, but they got out of it. So Fujitsu was left kind of holding this together. Now the government's come in and said, you know, I don't think we want to pay for this anymore. They just decided, you know, it's already cost them a few hundred million, and they recommended to cut basically $300 million out of the budget to build this thing. So they're sort of left holding this half-built thing, and they might not have a 10 petaflop system in the next few years. And it's, I think it's really depressing for the Japanese tech community. I mean, there were some comments in the Reuters thing that seem like, you know, there's people that are in Japan that are just basically abandoning the Japanese scientific community.
Yeah, I read the article, and I don't want to overreact to it, though, because it might have been a little bit thinly researched in terms of, you know, supercomputing expertise. For example, it talked about Japan failing to overtake U.S. dominance in the supercomputing industry ever since it's been failing and since 1992. And, you know, we all know that the Earth Simulator was the king of the supercomputing mountain in Japan during that time for a long time. So it's not right. Like Japan has perpetually been failing for 20 years. Furthermore, I think they're looking at potentially one ultra-scale, you know, multi-petascale system not getting funded and extrapolating that to mean that Japan isn't doing supercomputing at all. And that might be an overstatement. Now, it's certainly true that we've seen Japanese share of the supercomputing segment of the market. But I think if you went to, you know, Fujitsu and NEC and Hitachi and say, so I guess that means you're not doing supercomputers anymore, you might get an argument back.
Right. I think in a sense you're right. This new 10 petaflop system that they've been working on is sort of symbolic. It's not to say supercomputing won't go on in Japan, but there were a lot of universities and researchers looking towards this system, and there was a lot of grant money and research money that was going to be revolving around this system. So it was an important system. I mean, we've got multiple projects like this in the U.S. that are going for multi-petaflop, aiming that. So if one died, you know, the researchers and universities could maybe turn to the next one. Well, in Japan, that's not going to happen because this is their sort of one shot to get into the multi-petaflop arena on basically the same time frame as the U.S. and Europe.
Yeah, I get that. I mean, the way it was set up, they had all their wood behind one arrow, right? And now what I wonder is, if they cancel that, is it going to come back as a bunch of smaller things, right? Where you know, does that mean they're cutting off all their research, or are people going to file for other grants to do research just on their own on a collection of smaller computing resources? So that's why it's not clear to me how far-reaching the effect is yet. It could just be a decentralization, and I think we're going to need to wait and see. But you know, it is one of the ironic things about it is that the Seymour Cray Award just went out, and is one of the first awards we're seeing for supercomputing, and that one's going into Japan.
Right. It was Kenichi Mayura. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right. He's a professor at the National Institute of Informatics in Japan. He's also with Fujitsu, who was the primary contractor on that system. So, yeah, he's going to step up to the award at SCO9 and talk about, you know, the great things he's been doing and Fujitsu vector processors, which is the history there. And then the Japanese government decides to pull the plug out of the biggest supercomputing project they've ever gone on there. So that might be an interesting speech to watch.
Really interesting to see if Miura-san gets any questions about that at the end of his speech.
I'm guessing he will. And if not, people will be coming up to him after his speech and ask him about it, I'm sure. So that's sort of unfortunate timing for him, but maybe I'll have something interesting to say about that.
Well, and we're going to have a lot of interesting things to say as we go into Supercomputing Week. We're going to have a special production schedule departing from our regular Friday afternoon schedule. We'll have one show that we'll record at the end of the day Tuesday in Portland next week, and then follow that up with another one at the end of the day Thursday in Portland. And then we'll have our final post-show wrap-up on the following Monday, November 23rd, prior to the Thanksgiving holiday. That'll all be part of our line of supercomputing coverage, and then we'll take a break through Thanksgiving until we finally come back on December 4th with our regular schedule.
I can't wait. sounds good.
We're going to have much to talk about, Michael. We need that many shows to cover it.
Hey, we do. We're not even able to fit, you know, into a 20-minute show those three times, but we'll give it our best shot. There's going to be a lot of news. I think both you and I know about some of the news coming up that we can't quite talk about yet, but it's a lot of exciting announcements coming up. There's going to be a lot of news that it's just going to come out of a show that we don't know about. So we'll be plenty to have a conversation about over the next three shows.
Yeah, they're going to be big shows. It's going to be supercomputing itself is going to be a big show. I love this trade show. I can't wait to go up to Portland. We're going to be tired, but it's going to be fantastic.
Well, it'll be good to see you there in person for this time.
I'll see you in person up there this weekend, Michael. Travel safe, and I'll talk to you in Portland.
Talk to you then.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to HPC Wire Soundbite with Michael Feldman and Addison Snell. Got a question or comment for Michael or Addison? Email soundbite@hpcwire.com. HPC Wire Soundbite is available every Friday afternoon from iTunes or at hpcwire.com. HPC Wire, the leading source for global news and information covering the ecosystem of high productivity computing.